Metro Milwaukee versus Milwaukee County, Mr. Levine.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Levine, and I am appearing once again on behalf of the plaintiff appellant MMAC. This case involves more than an effort to regulate labor relations. This case involves what one county sponsor of Chapter 31 appropriately described as a precedent-setting fight to change the National Labor Relations Act.
Before you get into the crux of your argument, I just wanted to ask you this. If we determine that the county's motive in passing Chapter 31 is relevant, is the case really appropriate for summary judgment? I understand that you're asking us to direct judgment in your favor, but it seems to me that these motive questions are so hotly contested, and you know, not usually the kind of thing that one that you know the court resolves on summary judgment.
Your Honor, I think there's a possibility. It really depends on how you're going to look at motivation in this case. If we are going to spend time discussing the individual motivations of each county supervisor that participated in the discovery in this process. And there are conflicts in that testimony. You may be correct that their summary judgment could not be denied. There would be a question of fact for the trial court to resolve. If we're looking at motivation from the standpoint of what does the law say, how far does it reach, who does it help, who doesn't it help, how deeply into labor relations it goes to determine motivation, I think the answer is no. That can be decided by this court on summary judgment. During oral argument in the ripeness and standing phase of this case, this court, by Judge Posner, observed that Milwaukee County had adopted a regime which is inconsistent with the NLRA and asked the county the following question. Why would you think that making it easier for unions to organize would reduce the incidences of labor disputes? And in connection with this question, this court, again by Judge Posner, stated, quote, after all, the idea of the National Labor Relations Act against the background of serious labor unrest in the 1930s was that the scheme that Congress was adopting would minimize labor disputes, strikes, and lockouts. There is a federal labor peace ordinance called the National Labor Relations Act. Now, noting that the county was apparently not satisfied with the balance Congress struck under the NLRA, this court asked the same question in an even more pointed fashion, asking why the county thought that, quote, jettisoning the National Labor Relations Act leads to greater peace. These questions were left and remain unanswered both by the county and the district court. Your Honors, there is a reason the Supreme Court's decision in Boston Harbor is referred to as the market participation exception. The essence of preemption is that state and local government cannot pass laws that conflict with federal law, frustrate the federal scheme, or tread in areas where Congress sought to occupy the field to the exclusion of state and local action. In such cases, we would submit preemption is and must always remain the rule if the NLRA preemption doctrine is to have any meaningful life. Thus, when state or local government acts contrary to the rule and seeks the shelter of the market participation exception, its actions must be subject to the strictest possible scrutiny. A court must, as the courts in Gould, Boston Harbor, Lockyer, and Cardinal Towing, and as this court ordered in its remand, look under the hood to see what's really going on. I want to take a quote from the National Treasury Employees Union case, which I understand obviously is a First Amendment case, not a preemption case, but there is a quote that I think is applicable. When the government defends a regulation on speech as a means to redress past harms or prevent anticipated harms, it must do more than posit the existence of the disease sought to be cured. It must demonstrate that the recited harms are real, not merely conjectural, and that the regulation will, in fact, alleviate these harms in a direct and material way.
Mr. Levine, are the parts of Chapter 31 that you argue violate the First Amendment, are they severable?
I would say not, Your Honor. I think the for the following reason. The speech provisions of Chapter 31 are core to Chapter 31 itself. If you were going back to the testimony of various supervisors in the case, they indicated or seemed to indicate that it was pro-union or anti-union speech that was disruptive, that needs to be cured. And so they adopted fairly elaborate speech provisions to deal with this alleged problem. And I stress alleged. Your Honor, in sort of going to the core of the First Amendment issue, Chapter 31 basically says that the state has the right to commandeer my client's private property to give a forum to the union to speak to its employees. And because these speech restrictions go to the core of Chapter 31, I would say not severable, Your Honor.
I understand that you think the Sage case was wrongly decided by the Third Circuit, you acknowledged, of course, in your reply brief that the Supreme Court had denied cert. But is there a way to reconcile Sage with the new opinion in Lockyer from the Ninth and Cardinal Towing from the Fifth?
Well, it's interesting. The District Court in New York in the Pataki case says these tests are all the same. They see no difference. I frankly do see a big difference in how searching the analysis is. The Sage case, factually, is distinguishable. The proprietary interest at issue in Sage was basically the government acting as a partner and an investor in a land deal. We don't have a proprietary interest in this case at all, in my opinion. So factually, I think there's a way to distinguish Sage. But in terms of the test, I do think that there has to be a test that has a searching analysis. The fundamental problem with the district court's test in this case was the over deference that it gave to the government. There was no analysis. This was an I'll take your word for it case. If you put a few clever buzzwords in your statute that says you're pursuing a proprietary interest, I'm not going to second guess you.
But following what Judge Urban said, it doesn't sound like a problem with how the test is formulated, but how it's applied. Right? I mean, isn't the issue just there are two possibilities. One is that this measure was honestly designed in order to prevent possible interruptions in service, and the other is that it's a way of Milwaukee County opting out of the National Labor Relations Act. So don't we just have to choose between those, really?
I think you have to choose what level of scrutiny you're going to give to the action.
Well, I don't understand. I mean, as you said, didn't our opinion actually instruct the district judge to look into the motives?
Yes, it did.
Okay, so that's an instruction. Once you look at the motive, that's as searching as you can search, right?
Well,
so you think he didn't give any weight to them. So.
Well, not only did he not give any weight to it.
But if he didn't give any weight, then that's disobeying our mandate. And why do we have to worry about the details of how you formulate a standard?
Well, I think you have to formulate a standard, Your Honor, that is true to Boston Harbor. These courts say there's no standard, there's no test, we're going to have to search for one. But if you read a careful reading of Boston Harbor, gives you the factors. And frankly, it may in the end be a totality of circumstances test, but it gives you the factors that are key to the court's decision. And any test or any approach to these cases has to be true to Boston Harbor.
Well, would the Third Circuit and Sage have refused to look at some of those factors? I mean, would they say, well, the Supreme Court thinks this is important, but we don't?
I think the answer is yes. The court and Sage...
say that.
I think the court and Sage specifically rejected the typicality requirement that we believe Boston Harbor imposes, the quote-unquote typical market participant requirement. Now, interestingly, Sage in one hand said it's irrelevant, but in a footnote dropped in and said, you know, there may be circumstances where whether or not the conduct is typical of a market participant would be relevant.
Focus it this way. So suppose you're Milwaukee County and you're concerned, you don't want to have these old people, marooned because there's a labor dispute. So what would you advise the county to do to prevent that? That would be consistent with the National Labor Relations Act.
Well, I would go back to a comment in Boston Harbor, Your Honor, where the Supreme Court indicated that the Golden State case, which was the taxi franchise case...
I'm not asking you about cases. I'm asking you, how would you advise Milwaukee County to deal with the problem of service interruptions without stepping on the toes of the National Labor Relations Act?
Applied to this particular case, Your Honor, with the alleged transit issues...
Look, just answer my question.
I would advise them to go to the contractor, identify the problems that are occurring on the spot, and say, fix these problems or you're done as my contractor.
Okay, so you're suggesting that all Milwaukee County has to do is impose a penalty or liquidate damages or something or terminate a contract. So what you're saying is, if they put into the contract, if there are more than X service interruptions of how many minutes, the contract is canceled, or you have to pay, $1,000 an incident. So that would be perfectly lawful. Is there any legal obstacles?
No, I would say they're not, Your Honor, because of the Boston Harbor's reference to Golden State. That's what Boston Harbor said the government in Golden State should have done. In the event of a labor dispute, they hypothesized, if in fact the government was a purchaser of taxi services and taxi services were being disrupted by a labor dispute, Boston Harbor said the government could have gone directly to the contractor and said, fix this problem or we'll get another contractor. In this particular case, again, as a matter of contracting, get a performance bond. Have a contractor establish that in fact there is a second contractor who can provide services in the event its services are disrupted for any reason. I mean, that's if there's an interest to be protected, it's a general consumer's interest in receiving services. It's not services disrupted by labor disputes or any other thing.
Okay, why don't you save your time, the rest of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Levine. Ms. Robbins?
Good morning. May it please the court. Chapter 31 is an exercise of Milwaukee County's proprietary interest.
Well, you have a pretty thin facade here, don't you, Ms. Robbins? And why isn't Mr. Levine correct? Look, if a company has a problem, has a contractor, and maybe the contractor is delivering, ammunition to the Army or something like that, or Humvees to Iraq. If it has a problem, it says, look, prompt delivery is the essence of this contract. If you're not prompt, there are interruptions. We cancel you. Or, we have this liquidated damages clause, and every minute you delay, we're going to charge you $1,000. Why wouldn't that take care of the problem? And as Mr. Levine said, you don't care whether disruption is caused by a labor dispute or by a fire or by anything. You just want performance, and there are all sorts of ways in which you can get it without monkeying with labor relations, which gets you into a problem with the National Labor Relations Act.
Your Honor, I have two responses. First of all, Milwaukee County does not cover nuts and bolts, such as perhaps your munitions question, under the Labor Peace Ordinance. Milwaukee County has only focused on human services.
Completely. You're concerned about labor. You're concerned, is with interruptions in service.
That's right.
So why don't you just write your contracts with the service companies in a way that gives them a very strong incentive to avoid interruptions in service, and then they figure out how to deal with unions or fires or any other potential cause of a disruption?
Because there are certain services that Milwaukee County does not want to tolerate the disturbance first.
Of course
first.
Not, but the question
and
is, yes,
the,
I know, but
and
look,
Milwaukee County believes
going to
that
enter, wait, let me, a company isn't going to enter into a contract to guarantee uninterrupted service if, should it fail to do so, it's going to pay a very heavy price.
Your Honor, that was not Milwaukee County's choice.
Well, what sense
Milwaukee
does it make?
County's
I mean, other,
choice
other, look,
was that when it saw there was
hey, a wait, let me finish. There are a lot of situations in which interruptions in service are very bad, like a hospital strike, for example, or a police strike or something like that. Well, the usual way in which these interruptions are discouraged is by the terms in the contract. So what's special about this situation that a contractual sanction against interruptions is inadequate?
Your Honor, in this case, the contractual provision is that a contractor for certain services will enter a labor peace agreement. That is not an unusual way of addressing a particular disruption which comes from...
You're not answering my question.
I believed I was, Your Honor. For example, you mentioned hospitals, and that's a good example because we're very concerned about a disruption in a hospital. We're also concerned when it's social services in Milwaukee County. And what Milwaukee County did was it provided in its contract that for those types of services, when they were large contracts, the employer would agree that when faced with an organizing drive, there would be a labor peace agreement in place to avoid disruption.
Look, you're not you're following your own track, and you're not in my track. My question is very simple: why aren't the contractual alternatives adequate?
Because they're after the fact. And Milwaukee County has a right to make a determination that after the fact is not good enough.
Let me, I am quite troubled by the fact that the ordinance is so, well, it seems to be so open-ended. No limit to a certain project, no time limits. It seems to go so much further than Boston Harbor, you know, because of that. And you would help me if you address that.
Well, I think I can, Your Honor. I think on the one hand, it is quite limited. It only involves certain types of contracts and only during union organizing drives, and then only certain types of conduct that relate to the organizing drive itself. One way that you can see...
What happens?
One way.
Hey, look, you keep interrupting me. I mean, I interrupt you, but I have a right to
interrupt. Your Honor,
look,
sometimes I forget.
Look, you say it's very important. So that's a pretty good argument. You say it's very important to head these things off before they happen. Fine. Okay. But then why is it limited to organizing? That is, after the union has organized, what if it decides to strike? Then you have the interruption, and you haven't made any provision about that, which casts doubt on the sincerity of your concern with making sure that these interruptions are prevented in advance.
I'm going to add something. I'm going to interrupt
you. No, go ahead.
You, sure. Interrupting her. Who is
I hope I can remember the whole train.
Yeah, now I'm me too. And I'm wondering if you would add to what Judge Posner said, particularly in light of the, well, if it is true that most strikes and therefore most service disruptions occur during collective bargaining rather than during union organizing. You know, how can we say that Chapter 31 is, you know, specifically tailored to meet the county's proprietary needs, which I think is.
Well, I think on the one hand, it's okay for Milwaukee County to address one problem without addressing all problems. This particular problem had come to Milwaukee County's attention through a number of disruptive organizing drives. I will also point out that this is not the only type of agreement of this kind. What Milwaukee County did is it was faced with a problem. Organizing drives have caused disruption in services, and then looked for the solution. And the solution they found was that many employers had attempted to deal with this situation by having labor peace agreements. So then they looked at labor peace agreements, and they only focused on the places where they were most concerned about that disruption of services. And as it's turned out, after hundreds of contracts, there have only been 3 labor peace agreements. So we really are dealing with something much more like SAGE, where it only impacts a very few contracts.
Yeah, but
and in terms of the, I want to get back to, if I may.
But the point is,
my apologies.
If we buy your argument that 31 is an exercise of the county's proprietary interest, doesn't that open the door? I know you're pointing to just 3 cases, but we have to look beyond this case and look at the implications as it affect other cases. And doesn't it open the door to conflicting municipal labor ordinances across the country? And now municipalities that use some kind of financial penalty or have alternative service available if there's an interruption in service now can turn to this kind of agreement, and doesn't that just defeat the whole purpose of the Act?
Well, the Act has always recognized the ability of parties to have voluntary agreements concerning organizing. This is nothing new. This is something that has existed for decades. And so it's not that Milwaukee County developed anything new. It's been there all the time. Milwaukee County saw a particular problem with particular types of organizing drives where their citizens were ending up on street corners and so forth, and address that problem.
But other municipalities dealt with it, but there were limitations on how they dealt with it. You can't point to any municipality that has such a broad chapter as this 31 with no limits or anything on it.
Well, see, I guess I don't think it's that broad, and I think the way it's been used indicates that it's not that broad. And if you look at SAGE, there's an ordinance there that is focused on protecting financial interests, where in this case we are protecting service interests in providing services without disruption.
Could you lawfully have simply said no, contractors may not be unionized?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Why not? Why wouldn't you make the identical proprietary argument? One way to avoid union organizing disruption by union organizers, say, you know, we just don't make contracts with service providers that are unionized.
We picked a vehicle that was already accepted by the National Labor Relations Act.
Hypothetical.
I understand that. But we didn't look for a hypothetical. Oh, sorry.
I'm asking you a hypothetical question so I can see, you know, what the limits, the scope, and the theory behind your position is. So my question is, could you lawfully say, because we have this problem of disruptive organizing, no unions?
And I said, Your Honor, that I did not believe that was the case.
Well, what would forbid that?
I think that the National Labor Relations Act would forbid that.
Yeah, of course it would be inconsistent with the National Labor Relations Act, but your whole argument is that because you have a proprietary interest, you can opt out of the National Labor Relations Act. And you do it with this labor peace thing, which is pro-union. What about an anti-union solution that would have the identical protective effect for the county?
We picked a solution that the National Labor Relations Act had recognized. Just like the National Labor Relations Act had recognized project labor agreements,
are
the National Labor Relations Act recognized labor peace agreements.
You must learn that when we ask you questions, you stop speaking. That's elementary, right? I'm sure you've argued cases before. You know that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
We'll give you plenty of time to say anything you want.
Okay.
But just let me finish my question. Okay?
I apologize, Your Honor.
Now, you understand, surely, that if you do not have a proprietary interest, you cannot impose this ordinance. You agree with that, surely?
Your Honor, if we did not have a proprietary interest, we would then have to review Garmin and machinists and determine whether or not there is a conflict with a protected or prohibited act. And I'm not sure that there is, since, as I said, labor peace agreements have been recognized by the National Labor Relations Act.
Yes,
and as a matter of fact,
if you do have a proprietary interest, then you're not bound by the National Labor Relations Act. Isn't that correct?
If we do have a proprietary interest, we don't have to apply Garmin and machinists to determine if the ordinance is preempted.
And
then
I,
why couldn't you simply, if you have a proprietary interest, say no unions?
Your Honor, all I can say is that when you look at Boston Harbor, okay, Boston Harbor's vehicle was one that was consistent with the Labor Relations Act, and we believe the labor peace agreements are also consistent with the National Labor Relations Act. Private parties can agree this is the way we're going to handle the conduct of an organizing drive. This ordinance, in terms of its narrowness, for example, doesn't provide how a union is going to be selected or rejected. There's no card check provision. There's no neutrality. The labor peace agreements, those organizing drives, ended.
You could impose this on private employers in Milwaukee County who didn't have any contract with the county?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Absolutely
yes.
Not.
Okay, right. Your proprietary interest enables you to do things that you couldn't do if you didn't have a proprietary interest, if you didn't have a contract. Now my question is, why couldn't you say simply no unions? And the reason I ask you this is that I think the unions may be rather short-sighted in thinking that carving out a big exception from the National Labor Relations Act for proprietary activities helps unions. It just depends on the union sentiment of a particular county, city, what have you.
I will again make a parallel to Boston Harbor. A labor peace agreement is an accepted instrument to address the conduct of an organizing drive. It is consistent with the National Labor Relations Act. In this case, the county observed a problem, that being that there was disruption during organizing drives. And to solve that problem, it used a vehicle which already existed.
But why do you say that the county could not require this of private employers who had, if it's consistent with the National Labor Relations Act, why couldn't they just?
Because I do believe that would be regulating. The Milwaukee County did not regulate. It looked at a problem with the provision of its services, and it was only concerned with disruptions in its services in a very narrow scope.
But if it's within that narrow scope, can it ignore the National Labor Relations Act entirely and say no unions?
I don't believe that that's the teaching of Boston Harbor.
The Labor Relations Act doesn't apply to proprietary activities, does it?
It allows what the proprietary activity allows the county to do is to act as a private citizen would, which is to address a problem.
But doesn't it allow the county to opt out of the National Labor Relations Act?
I don't think that the county has. The county has adopted a requirement for labor priests agreements.
I'm lost.
So that the conduct of organizing drives will not result in disruption. It's very parallel
let me ask you
to
just
the,
one more question.
To Sage.
Let me ask you one more question. Why didn't we direct the district judge to look at the motive issue? And so shouldn't he have done that? Shouldn't he have weighed the difference? Obviously, many of the people involved in the decision-making just want to help union. That's perfectly clear. Now shouldn't their motives be some evaluation made of just how influential that current of thought was?
Well, Your Honor, in our brief, we pointed out that looking at the individual motives of supervisors or congressmen is not the way you analyze the motive behind a piece of legislation. Normally, you would look at the impact of that legislation, and we believe that the impact is consistent with the stated purpose, which is to avoid disruptions during labor disputes.
As Judge Rovner said, it appears to be under-inclusive, this focus just on organizing and other disruptions are fine. So when you have that kind of ambiguity, why not? And there have been cases. The Supreme Court, when it held some Louisiana case, it held that it was unconstitutional to teach, to require teaching of creation science. And they looked at statements by Louisiana legislators, which indicated the legislators believed that they were teaching Christianity, teaching a religious dogma. So there are precedents for that. And why isn't this a case where you'd certainly want to know what was in these people's minds?
I think, Your Honor, that the Minnesota versus Cloverleaf Creamery analysis would be the appropriate analysis if you were to go into motivation. And what you would look at is what the stated purpose is, and then whether there is evidence to indicate that this Congress did or the legislature did is consistent with the stated purpose. And here it certainly is. When you have disruptions during organizing drives, in the instrument that's been used is a labor peace agreement. That's what was used here. It's completely consistent with the purpose that was stated.
You have disruptions in a strike, right?
Excuse me?
What happens if there's a strike later and the service is interrupted? Then what do you do?
There may be a new ordinance in that case, Your Honor. That has not happened. Milwaukee County addressed the problem that they had had. They had not had a problem except in the organizing field. That's what they addressed. If there's a problem later on...
I thought you liked to deal with problems before they arise. I thought that was your idea.
Before the next one arises, yes, Your Honor.
So you need a broader ordinance.
Well, Your Honor... I think that this is not the construction industry. We do not have 8F agreements. And so in the non-construction area, when you're trying to deal with disputes, this is what can be addressed at this time. The organizing drives may result in no union recognition and no collective bargaining. If there is collective bargaining, there may have to be a need to address the problem if there's disruption. So far, that hasn't happened. The disruption has been in the organizing drive. That's where the ordinance was directed.
How many of these contractors are unionized?
These contractors, meaning
the ones,
the three that
you deal with, who provide these services to elderly, and you know,
I think a small minority, I would guess, Your Honor.
Most of them are not unionized.
That's a guess on my part, Your Honor, but that would be my belief.
Aren't you worried that if your labor peace ordinance is upheld and there's more unionization, there are also going to be more strikes, more unions?
That certainly hasn't been our experience up till now.
You say there aren't many that are organized, but if you have more organized because of the labor peace agreement, isn't that going to increase the likelihood of strikes?
I certainly don't know of any study that would indicate that was true. What Milwaukee County saw...
You don't have unions, right? You don't have strikes without unions.
Well, you can have strikes without...
You can.
Your Honor. And as a matter of fact, when you look at the organizing situation, that's in fact what Milwaukee County had experienced, was disruptions in service, even though there were no recognized unions, and it attempted to address that problem.
Something that really troubled me was that Judge Adelman said that MAC does not dispute that the county's asserted interest was purely proprietary. And if he didn't understand that... is everything built on sand here?
No, Your Honor, and I would understand it the same way, I have to tell you. Milwaukee County's concern is disruption in social services. I have never heard MMAC say that that's not a proper proprietary interest. The question comes in as to how you address that proprietary interest. And Milwaukee County looked at how you stop it during organizing drives, found that there were things called labor peace agreements, collected a labor peace agreement, looked at places that they existed, tried to basically tailor the language so it would be less intrusive, would not include card checks and so forth. So I think the dispute is how Milwaukee addressed the proprietary interest, not that the disruption of service, I don't think there's any question disruption of service is a proprietary interest.
But you agree that's justiciable, that just because you have a proprietary interest doesn't give you carte blanche.
No, I think you have to go through the rest of the analysis. I think Judge Adelman's application of Judge Chernoff's decision in Sage is a very appropriate way of doing it. I would note that the Pataki case basically confirmed that with approval the test that he had developed, although in that case you had something that was far broader than the Milwaukee Chapter 31. You covered all contracts, and you covered anything an employer would say about a union, and it's not necessarily limited to union contract operations. This is far, 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 far narrower. It's so much narrower, they're not in the same league. It only involves certain contracted services. It doesn't go to any of the other activities of a contractor, only the contracted services, and then only in an organizing drive, and then only the conduct of the organizing drive, not how you select whether there's going to be a union or not. That's not covered by it.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Robbins.
Thank you.
Mr. Levine, how much time does he have? 7 minutes? Well, you will take 7 minutes, we hope.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. There are a few points that I do want to address that I think are quite important. First of all, Your Honor, in response to your question about how do we expose motivation without looking at what each one of the supervisors have said, I would encourage you to look at the speech provisions of Chapter 31 itself. Why are there two different standards for speech, one for employers and one for unions? The employer is prohibited from expressing to employees false or misleading information that is intended to influence the determination of employee preference regarding union representation. The union is prohibited from misrepresenting to employees the facts and circumstances surrounding their employment. Why not just say everybody is barred from false and misleading statements in order to convince employees that they should either vote for or against a union? Why not have a single standard unless you're trying to give one side an advantage over the other side? And then, which the district court did not address, there is absolutely no explanation, and this is what the district court's test says they're doing, which is what's the reasonable explanation of the county as to how these labor conditions relate to the advancement of the proprietary interest. In order to conduct that analysis, and it was never done, you would have to look at each one of the labor conditions in Chapter 31 and say, how does that advance the cause of labor peace? And what is it, for example, take these transit issues that the county keeps talking about. Was there any evidence that in any of those situations the problem was created because the contractor refused to give the union the names, addresses, and telephone numbers of its employees? Was there any evidence that problems were created because the employer didn't provide a forum on its private property for the union to speak to employees? Was there any evidence that a problem was created simply because the employer chose to lawfully exercise its speech rights under the National Labor Relations Act? Those things are missing, and that expose, Your Honor, the thin facade that you referred to earlier on. There also was a question, Your Honor, that you asked about before-the-fact regulation versus after-the-fact. I think, again, what exposes the thin facade that Chapter 31 is that there is a back-end analysis that still applies under Chapter 31. Remember, under Chapter 31, if a contractor either refuses to enter into a labor peace agreement or enters into one and breaches and experiences disruptions, according to the county can still decide that the contractor is doing such a good job or is so important that they're going to be relieved of the labor peace obligations. This was a point that Amicus National Labor Relations Board very persuasively made in its brief. Your Honor, I want to cite, as I close down here, footnote 4 of the Sage decision, where the court stated, in the real world, one can often plausibly contend that everything is related to everything else. We read the Gould-Boston Harbor distinction as requiring a much tighter fit between the procurement condition and the proprietary interest being advanced. There is no fit that has been established in this case. In Gould, the Supreme Court warned of the harm to be done by allowing local governments to create their own labor policies in conflict with the NLRA. Quote, each additional statute incrementally diminishes the board's control over enforcement of the NLRA and thus further detracts from the integrated scheme of regulation created by Congress. As we've said in brief, the harm predicted in Gould is now at hand. If the district court's decision becomes the standard by which local government intervention in private labor relationships is judged, what is left of NLRA preemption doctrine in the government procurement sector? There will be no limits on the type of union agreements, labor peace, card check, neutrality, that state and local governments can now impose on their private contractors under the guise of market participation. Whether we're talking about health and human services, snow plowing, sanitation.
Anything concrete you have to say, or are you repeating yourself?
I hope not to be repeating myself, Your Honor.
Repeating what's in your brief.
I would take issue with the claim that's been made that the conduct of the county is both lawful and common among private industry employers. I've been a practicing labor lawyer for almost 18 years. I've handled hundreds of union campaigns. I don't have any clients with these agreements. I don't have any clients that have sought out these agreements. I don't have any clients who have had their customers.
Mr. Levine, is this part of the record?
Mm-hmm. Your Honor, but...
Let me ask you, connected to that.
Yes.
So if one of these contractors wanted to have a labor peace agreement, what would it do? Would it just announce that... How do you... I mean, I can...
How do these unfold?
I understand how you can for it, but how would the contractor bind itself? Because this is before a union appears on the scene. So it's worried about disruptive union organizing, wants to have a labor peace agreement. What would it do? Would it just make an announcement that it will follow Ordinance 31 or something?
I'm not sure how it would go about doing that. Under Chapter 31, a union must come and request a labor peace agreement for all of these procedures.
So maybe that's the answer. If a union went to one of these contracts, suppose Milwaukee County said, well, instead of the labor peace agreement, what we're going to do is if any contractor has an interruption of service, we are going to take his firstborn and sell him into slavery. Okay? So that makes the contractor very nervous. So as soon as a union appears on the scene, he offers a labor peace agreement.
That's not how it works, Your Honor, under Chapter 31.
No, I understand. Okay. But I'm saying if there were no Chapter 31, I mean, the question is, suppose Mr. Robbins is correct, and labor peace agreements are a way of reducing union organizing. And suppose a contractor, for whatever reason, doesn't want an interruption of service. So can the contractors say, if a union goes to a contractor, wants to organize, or the contractor learns that the union is, signing up people, can he just make the labor peace agreement with the union?
Not necessarily. Under the National Labor Relations Act,
it would not be illegal.
There are certain agreement provisions that could constitute violations of Section 8A1, 82, and 83. An employer runs the risk, and a union runs the risk, of appearing to dominate a union relationship when they enter into these agreements. These very issues mm-hmm. are pending before the National Labor Relations Board right now mm-hmm. in the Heartland industrial case and in the Dana Corporation case.
That's okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Robbins. Very interesting argument.